Well, this is Bulldog Drummond, better known as John Drummond, and we're listening, of course, to Gangland Wire today, and thanks for the good intro. It makes, I might sign you up as an agent when you talk that big to me. All right.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we're going back to Chicago. I foresee a multi-episode show here about Harry Alleman, and we have sitting at the table via the Skype line. Our good friend and outfit expert from Chicago, who was we've had on the show before, Mike Byrne. Mike runs the Facebook page, the Chicago Outfit, old and current news articles. It's a great Facebook page. He posts all kinds of old articles out of the Chicago Tribune, and then people who get on and comment, people who were primary sources, really, people who were witness to a lot of these activities. And I think he's even got some outfit guys that like to listen to that every once in a while, or watch that every once in a while and read those articles. Mike, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks, guys. Glad to be back.
All right. So I guess you're familiar with Harry Alleman. Is that correct?
Oh, correct. Oh, yeah. He's a very, very well-known figure in the Chicago area, especially in the annals of the outfit history.
He was a stone killer. I even remember hearing about him down here in Kansas City in the 70s as being this stone killer up in Chicago. They call him just a little intro.
Yeah, I believe actually. Yeah, I remember. Like, I think they actually even tried to link some murders in the Kansas City area to Harry at one point. I can't remember exactly what murders, but I mean, I don't think he was ever convicted or ever. But yeah, they tried to. I think he had some links to some of the Kansas City guys at some point, and so we were looking into seeing if Harry was involved in some of the murders. I believe this had to be in the mid-70s, probably.
Yeah, they must have. We had a little mob war in the 70s, the middle 70s. I remember the deal. It was mainly this one guy, David Bonadonna, that purportedly they brought Harry Alleman down to kill him. And I don't know. I mean, nothing really seemed to come out of it other than I read it in the newspaper. I don't remember the Bureau, the FBI, talking about it, any specific information. But, you know, you never know. Chicago and Kansas City, as you know, and all of our wiretappers know, they're notoriously closely aligned families, so with Chicago being the big brother and Kansas City being the little brother. But they're two distinct families, but they're really closely aligned. You know, he had the moniker, the Hook, Harry the Hook Alleman, because he was started out in Golden Gloves. He was a great boxer with a good hook, a good left hook, I believe.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah, he was an amateur boxer in his younger days, and the funny thing is then there was also Angelo the Hook LaPietra, who was an outfit boss, but he got his nickname for other reasons. But but yeah, Harry was at one time amateur boxer in his younger days, and I guess right before he kind of got in a life of crime, I guess when he actually won some money in a boxing match, and he actually put the money towards buying nice clothes and stuff like that, because he was, you know, he wanted to kind of, you know, do the town and stuff, though. But yeah, I guess he was a really, you know, he was a really, really good boxer at one time, I heard.
Yeah, you know what I find interesting before we go back into his childhood, which I want to talk about a little bit, is, you know, our mutual good friend Red Womet, and we had a show with him, and I know you've talked to him a lot and continue to, and he talked a lot about, and his main guy that he was friends with in the outfit, or maybe friends would be not a good term, but was Frank the German Suisse. And Frank the German, he got to know Red because he was a collector and he was an enforcer for Joey Lombardo and the Grand Avenue crew, Well, Harry Alleman really was the counterpart as for Joe Ferroglia and the Taylor Street crew. He was a collector and an enforcer. Just he was a lot like Frank the German Suisse. He was a stone killer, and he was a guy they both of them were the guys they sent out to do the enforcement activities.
Exactly. Harry, he was the, I worked for Joe Ferroglia, and his little crew, they referred to him as the Wild Bunch. Like him and Butch Petroselli and James and Andino and those guys, because those guys were just ruthless. Those guys would do they would do whatever it took to get the money, or they got the go ahead to do the killing. They had no problem, and they always succeeded. They never had a problem. I don't think they ever even failed. I mean, I think one time there was a murder that they kind of messed up, but besides that, those guys were ruthless. They would do whatever it takes to get the job done.
You know, Harry Alleman was not full Italian. He had a Hispanic father, being from Mexico. Yeah, actually, I see my notes here. He's a native of Durango, Mexico. Harry and the Alleman family had a brownstone building in 917 South Bishop in Chicago that was owned by the family, and all the extended family lived there, which is pretty common. It was just west, I think, a little bit south of the Loop. Would that be about right? Are you familiar with that address, 917 South Bishop?
Oh, correct. Yeah, that was very common back then, especially in those neighborhoods. I mean, you had the grandparents, the parents, the children, and I mean, especially in those kind of in the inner city families like that, they would buy the three flat buildings, and the whole extended family would just live in one building basically. But yeah, it was basically just southwest of the Loop area of Chicago.
I wonder, is that building still there?
You know what I heard? Actually, because it's right near where the University of Chicago is now, and I know that that's where the Taylor Street area is, where that was a big breeding ground for a lot of mobsters, like the 42 gang guys. And that area, a lot of houses got torn down. The college ended up buying a lot of property. I don't know if Harry's house was one of the things but there was a lot of guys, a lot of old, that whole area now looks nothing like it used to. I mean, it's all... even now it's like they have condos being built, stuff like that. So that area is really getting gentrified heavily right now. So it wouldn't surprise me if the house was gone, probably.
You know, what's interesting is we had Frank Calabrese Jr. on, and he grew up in kind of the same circumstances. They had a three-story house. It wasn't a brownstone, but it was a three-story house with all the extended relatives living together in that house with his father kind of ruling over everybody. And Harry Alleman's father, Louis Alleman, he was he ruled over that whole family. Harry Alleman once described him in a probation interview as kind of a Mexican godfather who was involved in narcotic trafficking.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, Harry, I remember people saying, like I'm reading some information on articles on him. Harry said his father was a really rough guy, and he was known to beat Harry and stuff. So I don't think Harry had the easiest upbringing as a child, which kind of probably maybe kind of pushed him towards the career he ended up, choosing in life later on. But yeah, I think his father was in and out of jail and prison and stuff. So I don't think the father was around very much either, but when he was around, I think I remember reading Harry was beat and stuff, and him and Harry's brothers were beaten and stuff. So I don't think it was a very happy household.
Yeah, it didn't sound like it. Actually, in that same probation interview, I've got some quotes from it. Quote, Harry said, he beat me every day until I left home. He used his fist or a horse whip. If I looked at him the wrong way, he beat me. If my mother stepped in, she got hit herself. So he was, he was what we now call an abused child from a dysfunctional family, I would say.
He learned how to take a punch.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. He's definitely a product of that era and of that, that whole environment, the father's ruling with an iron fist and stuff. And obviously his father was a criminal. So, I mean, Harry probably just learned from his father, because I know Harry actually went to college for a year or two after he left high school and stuff, and he was actually a really good artist. So he actually had some aspirations there, trying to actually have a legitimate career at one point, but I think just the criminal activity just kind of, overshadowed that.
Yeah, it's, when you come from that background in that neighborhood, you don't have the connections, and it's hard to get going. And plus, being in that time, early 50s.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I know they were very poor. Yeah, that neighborhood was never that was not a wealthy neighborhood. So I mean, and it was a very rough neighborhood too. So I mean, you had to be a fighter or a scrapper to kind of kind of, you know, it's either, you know, yeah, I mean, either you take shit or you're going to eat shit, you know, one of those kind of neighborhoods. So
yeah.
I think Harry just kind of learned, you know, basically he didn't want to eat shit. So I figure Harry just, you know, kind of, you know, started like, you know, like I said, that's a problem. I mean, I'm assuming that's what why he probably got into boxing, probably. Like a lot of those young guys did. They, you know, they wanted to learn how to fight, you know, just for their own protection.
Now, you know, his first arrest was in 1960. For malicious mischief in 1961 for gambling, 1962 for possession of burglary tools, assault, and criminal damage. That sounds to me like he got caught by an owner trying to break into a business or something, wrapping up burglary tools, assault.
I don't know if it's in your notes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if it might be in your notes or not, but I know he was arrested also couple years later. He broke into the Tribune or Sun-Times building. Him and another guy, they were breaking into vending machines and stealing the coins out.
No, yeah.
And they got caught by a security guard in there.
I didn't have
that. Yeah, so obviously, I mean, it's amazing the lengths those guys would go to make any, I mean, to break into a vending machine even.
Yeah.
I mean, that just showed, I mean, obviously, I guess if you break into 100 vending machines in one night, you're gonna make some good money, but, like, it just seems like a lot of work for such little, you know, for a couple quarters, you know, or something like that. But I mean, those guys, you know, even talking to Red stuff about, you know, because Red knew a lot of these guys, like Harry, 99% of them were burglars and thieves before they got involved in the outfit, and that's how the outfit picked these guys. You know, they were burglars, thieves, you know, and that's how they got their that was their trade. Most of these guys, most of the guys who ended up doing a lot of killings for the outfit were basically just, you know, guys like Tony Spilotro, you know, Harry Alleman, they were all, Joey Lombardo, they were all just thieves and burglars. And, you know, in order to make more money and take that next step, they, you know, they had to, you know, start, you know, being a hitter and doing the heavy work for the outfit bosses. And that's how they moved up the ladder so quickly.
Oh, yeah, his rap sheet, these are just the things he got caught for and was convicted for. That's the only thing that ends up on on a rap sheet later on, is he graduates to from the burglary tools, assault, and criminal damage to aggravated assault to grand theft auto and armed robbery and aggravated kidnapping. It's just a progression of crimes. And those are, like I said, those are the ones he got caught.
But yeah, what amazes me is the fact that these guys can, like, these guys get caught. I mean, right there, you named probably like five arrests right there. If it was me and I got arrested, I'd be in jail for 5 years with my luck. These guys just skated on all, you know, they would get probation. And well, you know, back then, they hired the right lawyers, you know. They knew what lawyers to hire. I mean, it was really, everything was fixed back then, too. So, you know, a guy like Harry gets pinched for assault, you know, he just hires one of the mob lawyers, you know, and then next thing you know, which will play the bigger role in Harry's life later on with the 1977 trial, which we'll get to later, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I think that's why these guys had such long criminal records with no long stretches in prison, because they just knew how to play the system. They knew what lawyers to use and knew what judges to use, and they knew who to pay.
Yeah, really. While we're in his early life, let's talk a little bit about his personal family life, which I know you have talked to his daughter. His children love him, or his stepchildren, actually, and they love him today.
Yeah, stepchildren, yeah.
And it's kind
of, I guess, he had a childhood injury. He was a teenager, I believe. He fell into, like, you know, I think it was a loose sewer cap he fell into, and it tore his scrotum.
Oh.
And when that happened, he couldn't have children anymore, the doctor told him.
Oh, really? I didn't realize
whatever happened in the injury, and that's why Harry was never able to have his own children. It wasn't because of any choice. He wanted to have children, according to his stepdaughter, but due to that injury as a child, the doctor told him that there was no way he could ever reproduce a child.
Well, he found a
That's the story I heard from you know, his daughter and stuff, or stepdaughter.
Yeah, it sounds rational and logical. Sounds like
ring a truth to it. Sound like, you know, yeah.
He found what was described as a beautiful, young, spunky widow with several children. The built-in family named Ruth Mustari, who kind of came with some credibility because she had been married to an outfit connected mobster who was a guy named Frank Mustari, who had been killed in the attempted murder of a hijacker and a tavern owner, somebody who had gotten crossways with the outfit, and I think he was sent out to kill him back in 1957. and he had ended up getting killed. So
exactly, yeah. I think it was Frank and like maybe one or two other guys went to clip this guy, and the guy had like he was carrying, and he fired back, and it's good to see people actually defend themselves and actually fight back for a change. But Frank was killed in that it was 57. Yeah, that's right.
She was kind of the ultimate mob wife. She always stood by Harry's story, no matter what, and she stood by him. He'd been trying to create paintings, which he was gave him something to do in the penitentiary later on, and the family was broke a lot, but she always stood by him, no matter what.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, she did. Like according to like his stepdaughter, it was a very close knit family. Once Harry and the mother started dating and things like that, it was a really cool, according to her, Harry was always made sure he was always home at nighttime with the family, and he always wanted to know about how their day was and everything. So I think a lot of guys who grew up with a father who beat them in such a household like that, it seems like they kind of tend to want to like have that family, that close family, that he didn't have growing up. So it seems like Harry kind of wanted that. And I think Ruth is, his wife, I think she kind of, she had a ready-made family. She had kids already. So for Harry, it was a great situation for him. He could just, since he couldn't have his own children, he got to step in and play the role of a father, which, and it seems like, according to this, everything his daughter told me, he seemed like he was, outside of the stuff you read about and the outfit stuff, it seemed like he was always home and was always there for the family whenever they needed him.
Now, interesting. Of course, he did have a little bit of night work, I'm sure. He was kind of known.
Oh, shit, that's the part
maybe,
I had.
I was going to say, maybe
I,
that's
I,
why
I
he kept getting caught.
Oh, he was
working during the day.
It seems like, yeah.
At an early age, he was known as the Sheik because he dressed so dapper and so nice. And you look at these images of him when he's going in and out of court, places like that, he always is, really looks the part of a young businessman. He doesn't really look like he doesn't wear.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, he always had the suit on and the dark glasses and everything. Yeah, and he always kind of had that. He always had kind of had that like very serious look. You never like you see some of these guys who would joke around with the camera or talk. He just always had kind of had that really like, he always dressed real nice and impressed though. He was impeccable dressed, and then he always kind of had that like 1,000-yard stare though.
Yeah.
At the same time, the kind of menacing little look to him.
He did. I noticed that in some of those news clips where he's actually in the video. He does have a dead-eyed look that you would not want that guy coming to you and say.
Oh, yeah. He's not a guy you'd want angry at you, that's for sure.
he didn't mind fighting. He wasn't a big guy, but he was a boxer. And, one of his early altercations where he got in trouble, he ended up beating up a son of a Chicago police captain. They claimed that he sucker punched him with his left hand, but he broke the dude's jaw, and he ended up getting 2 years probation on that one. That was at a barroom brawl under one of those Rush Street bars back in the 60s.
Yeah, that was a big Rush Street in the 60s. That was the playground for those guys. They would go there and drink and fight, and because all the bosses owned all the restaurants down there. So guys like Harry and those guys would just go down there and drink, and then if someone looked at them cross-eyed, that's all it would take for those guys to start fighting.
So let's get back to his connection to the outfit. Now his mother's relative was his first connection into the outfit. Joe Ferriola was was married to the sister of Harry Edelman's mother, who was Italian. It was his father was Mexican, if you remember. And Joe Ferriola kind of took young Harry under his wing and brought him in, so to speak, and started using him and bringing him in, put him together with Butch Petroselli and another guy who will end up being not such a good partner, Louis Almeida. And a couple other guys.
Yep.
These other names I didn't know. You know them? James Endino.
Yeah, James. Endino. Yeah, he's a Cicero guy. He was another guy who was like, you know, very similar to Harry, very similar reputation, not a guy you'd want to fool around with, and very known to be a very deadly guy. He had Butch, Jimmy Anandino, and Harry, those guys were three guys that, like, I mean, if they came to your, if they, you know, if you were bookmaking or, you know, doing something without approval and you saw those guys come in, you knew you were in trouble. And James Anandino now, he's actually still, according to the feds, he's the boss of Cicero currently.
Oh, really?
This day, nowadays, he's still active. But yeah, like those guys you mentioned right there, they were all kind of running buddies in the early days there. And they were, oh, you know, all working for Joe Ferriola at the time.
All hanging out at the Survivor Social and Athletic Club?
Correct.
Now, do you know what's there now? Is there anything there? I tried to look on, figure out where it was on Google Maps or Google Google Earth.
The Survivors Club?
Yeah.
I believe the original location on Taylor Street is a dry cleaners now.
Okay. So there is a building there. And, it's just west of Racine.
Just west of Racine. It's right over there. It's a dry cleaners next door, like a little pizzeria next door to it. And then I believe that once it moved to Elmwood Park in the late 80s, then it turned into condominiums. But in its heyday, it was the Taylor Street days when it was located on Taylor Street.
So that's probably the place that they hung out and met up with Joe Ferriola and kind of got their orders for the day, so to speak, and came back and shared their scores, I would imagine, drank coffee, sat around out in front and sunned themselves.
Oh, correct. Yeah, that area, especially back then, the Taylor Street was completely just, you know, controlled by the outfits. So those guys, you know, I mean, that was their, I mean, they didn't have to fear anything in that neighborhood. I mean, it'd be so hard for the police or the feds to even do surveillance on that neighborhood just because, I mean, everyone was like, everyone knew those guys. So if a cop or a fed was in the area, they would just tip those guys off and say, hey, you know, we saw a guy doing, kind of a guy in a strange car driving through. But yeah, those guys, the Survivor Club, yeah, those guys, they go there in the morning, meet up, and then, you know, plot their, you know, do their stuff, and then go out and, you know, I mean, from what I've read, I mean, they would be there on a daily basis, those guys. It was like, that was like basically their job. You know, they would go be there each morning, and then, you know, by nighttime, they would, you know, do it, you know, whatever they planned, they would go do and meet up there the next morning then again.
I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, when we, all the time we've talked about these different social clubs around the country, that why wouldn't the FBI, if you will, come in and rent an apartment across the street upstairs, you know, three doors down or whatever, and set up their surveillance and do photography and stuff of these guys? Didn't they wiretap
them? I think, I don't know if they ever got a wire in the Survivors Club on Taylor, but I think the problem, I mean, because that's, in theory, that's a great, I mean, I know the feds have done that in the past with, like, other city mobsters, but I think on Taylor Street, I mean, it's so, back then it was 100% Italian, so just, I mean, if the feds even find someone willing to let them use an apartment, that would be difficult for the feds even, because everyone there knew these mobsters, so they, even if they didn't like the guys, they knew if word got out that they rented their apartment to a fed, I mean, they could end up in a trunk of a car. So I think, I mean, it was just, I mean, the two neighborhoods at the time, the Grand and Ogden neighborhood and the Taylor Street neighborhood, I mean, I've talked to former police officers in Chicago, and they said those were the two neighborhoods. It was the hardest neighborhoods to ever do surveillance in. They had the hardest time. They were basically, if they were following someone, if they got to that neighborhood, they would just break it off because they knew they would just be busted within minutes of entering that neighborhood. So I think I'm surprised they didn't try to drop a wire in. That's the one thing I don't think they ever successfully got a wire in the Survivors Club, but that would seem like that'd be the most probably best thing to do because they could break in the middle of the night unless they had someone maybe stay in there in the club overnight just to protect it. But I don't know if they went that far to do that.
Yeah, and also you may, if you really knew what was going on at the time, you may learn that these guys, if they had conversations, they walked back out in the parking lot and did walk and talks. They never used the phone. They may have been extremely careful. I know in our social club here in Kansas City.
Oh, yeah, they were very cautious.
They were still talking in code.
Yeah, I think that was the one thing those guys were good with is, like, yeah, they would, I mean, if they were talking about something, like, highly sensitive, they would, go outside or, go for a walk and talk.
Yeah, see, they may even had a wire in there, had a microphone in there, and if you don't end up using it and you don't get enough to go, you know, charge somebody in court, and then it comes in a court case, then you're never going to, they're just going to put it in a folder and let it go to the archives eventually. Nobody will ever know it even existed outside the FBI. Well, they do have to notice up everybody that they actually overheard. So the guys who were heard on the wire, the mic, if they identify their voices, they'll get a letter saying that they overheard them. But other than that, the general public will never know.
They notify them?
Yeah, anybody, if somebody calls you and they're being wiretapped and they identify you, then when the case is over and they're either going to trial or they're not, whatever, when the case is over, they'll send all those people a notice saying that they've been monitored on a wiretap under Title III of the U.S. Code. So at this point in time, Joe Ferriola has an idea, and I believe what the research I did said that I learned that he said he wanted to organize bookmakers like speakeasies, and people selling bootleg booze were organized in Chicago in the 30s and get them organized and then lay a street tax on them. And that's one of the early things that Butch Petroselli and Harry Aleman and his little crew did for Joe, was go out and identify these guys and line them up and send them the message that they're going to have to start paying a street tax.
Yep, they were very good at doing that, too. Those guys were, you know, I mean, they probably, I can't imagine how many bookmakers they shook down. I mean, I know, I remember Robert Cooley, the former corrupt lawyer, said one time, like, Harry would even, like, he would, you know, they have friends in the police department that would tip him off if, like, a bookmaker got arrested. They would tip him off, and by the time the bookmaker made bail, one of the guys in the crew would be waiting for him outside the police station, and they would grab him, basically, and just say, hey, you know, you've been bookmaking without permission for the last 2 years, so you owe us this much money, and then you owe us this much a month. Or sometimes they would even just read the newspapers, and if they saw a bust in the paper, they would track the guy down from that way. So these guys, I mean, they would go to any length, because they all got a piece of that too, and, you know, a small portion. That's how they made their livelihood, most of these guys too.
And they were also doing home invasions and burglaries. They'd get tips on, who had a coin collection or who had something pretty decent worth stealing. And as it progressed, of course, the first time Joe Ferriola was a man, and he would, everything would have to be turned over to him, and then he'd give each guy back $500. Now, eventually, I believe Harry Aleman will be the guy that kind of puts these crews together, and they sends them out, and they go out and do these burglaries, and then they get $500, and he gets all the booty. I mean, interesting way that they did things.
I think Harry was, learned from Joe, from Ferriola, just how he did things, and then, he had his, then, Harry put his own crew together, and they'd go out of town. They'd go to Indianapolis. They would go all. I mean, they would travel out of state. If there was enough money involved, they would travel for some of these robberies and burglaries.
Well, they weren't going to be doing them in Little Italy or Cicero or anywhere there in Chicago, really, were they? I mean, they could some, but like freight hijacks maybe or something like that. But it just seems like, you don't necessarily want to be in your backyard doing that all the time. And so, yeah, I could see them going out of town.
I think probably in their neighborhood they probably didn't hit anybody unless it was a bookmaker, doing it operation. But a lot of these guys usually a lot of those neighborhoods, the bosses would, give a stern warning to say, like, unless the boss came down and gave a strict, going, hey, you can hit this guy's house in this area. But yeah, most of the time, they would kind of stay away from their own neighborhoods and stuff. And they would hit a lot in the suburbs of Chicago, because north suburbs was a really wealthy, a lot of wealthy areas up there. So those were always good hot spots for outfit guys, the houses up there.
Another story that I learned about Harry Aleman when he was getting into this business, especially of helping the loan sharks collect money and line up the bookmakers is a couple of Chicago loan sharks were convicted of extortion and sent to prison. And what they had done, they had gone to their victim and wanted to collect a debt, I think it was $6,500, and they said that Harry Edelman would be the next one that would come after this guy if he didn't pay, so he paid up. And in fact, later on, the prosecutors would say that was just a ruse. They were just dropping Harry Edelman's name. He wasn't connected to the deal in any way. So.
Oh, that's why, that's a true story, and that just shows you how much people feared Harry at that time. Just the mention of his name was enough that these people would just pay up if they owed any money, because, you know, they knew if they saw Harry next, they probably, you know, they weren't going to get another chance after meeting Harry.
So, Mike, we've been going 45 minutes right now. Let's go ahead and close this down. You'll come back and talk with us next week about our good friend Harry the Hook Edelman, won't you?
Sounds good. Yeah, definitely.
All right, great, Mike. I'm going to do a public service announcement, and we will shut this show down. It's been great talking to you.
Great talking to you guys, too.
If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
You need to follow the Facebook group.
Chicago Outfit, old and current news articles.
And then, of course, follow Gangland Wire on Facebook, because you're going to find out great information. And you want to go out to Amazon and buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase or rent as a streaming movie.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Mike.
Goodnight, guys.
That's the choruses. I asked the district manager, and he didn't have any idea, and I played the song, the other song back. He didn't know either on that one. And, yeah, but made me, I went back, before the show Monday, I had watched SNL. They used to do these Jeopardy, Celebrity Jeopardies.
Yeah.
And so they'd have, you know, the people doing impressions like Alex does. So I watched one of those videos where they had Sean Connery. It's just a really funny line. One of the categories was an album cover. and Sean Connery's like, I'll take Anal Bum Cover for $400. just hilarious. So then Alex comes in, and we're kind of talking about that on the air.
You're too hot over there. Yeah. You weren't too hot over here, but you're.
Yeah,
too
I
hot
could
over
tell.
There.
I was looking over there at the recording on the edge. I can still see when it comes through. It was.
That looks about right.
That looks probably a little better.
Yeah, that's better.
That would line is a little sensitive.
If you come back over there, then you'll be. All right, I'm gonna call him. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Is it cold and wet up?
I missed your call the first time around.
That's all right. Is it cold and wet up there like it is down here?
It's a little chilly, but it's actually pretty sunny out. But it's got like maybe it's in the 50s about right now, maybe upper 40s.
Oh, well, that's warm for
Chicago. Yeah, actually, no, we got a little rain. What was that?
That's warm for Chicago in the spring, 50s. Hell, that's...
Oh, definitely. Well, it's supposed to be 80 on Monday.
Oh, really?
Here. So that's a heat wave for us, but yeah. I don't know if that'll actually happen or not. But, yeah, I just moved today to my new apartment.
I saw that online on Facebook. I thought, well, damn, we could have put this off a little bit longer.
No, it's cool. Okay. I can do it. I can do the interviews, no problem.
Okay.
And, like, it's funny because, like, you know, the area I moved to is, like, the heart of Mob Central in Chicago.
I saw that.
And
was it Tate?
Within 1 hour, I ran into I ran into a Grand Avenue street crew member. The minute, like, within 1 hour, I ran into somebody.
Trying to get some pizza.
He was pretty friendly, though. He wasn't being, you know, he's kind of like, you know, I mean, he's an older guy. He's like, you know, Joey Lombardo's age. He used to be part of Lombardo's crew, but now he's just kind of he's like 72 now, this guy. He's kind of just, you know, he's just kind of an old timer who just kind of lounges around the neighborhood.
They got a social club in that neighborhood?
Actually, they do. It's funny because the one they used to use, did you ever watch the Michael Mann show Crime Story?
Oh, yeah.
It was on TV. The first season, they always, like, that Ray Luca was always using that social club.
In
a TV show. Well, that's the actual social club that the Grand Avenue crew used, which is two blocks from me.
Oh, really?
And, like, they still use it occasionally. In the summertime, you'll see a lot of the old-timers out there just kind of hanging out. But there's a hardware store across the street, and I guess they use the back room for, like, card games and gambling and stuff.
So, this is...
You mean for a cover?
For a cover, yeah. This isn't the Survivors Social and Athletic Club on Taylor Street, is it?
No. That's the Marco. That's Marco D'Amico's. That's the one that was on Taylor Street, the Survivors one, yeah.
Well, interesting.
Then it moved then in the late 80s. It moved to Elmwood Park then, like in the late 80s, I think. I think when Marco got indicted in the early 90s, when the Survivors Club shut down.
Well, that's a maybe.
I think it's a condominium now.
Yeah, gentrification at its finest.
Oh, exactly. Oh, God, this neighborhood here. I mean, it's funny because you can still see a lot of like the. Of what the old neighborhoods used to look like, but it's slow. It's starting to really change over now with like the condos coming in and stuff. So you still have all the old Italian restaurants and stuff, but then you still, but then you have these new like cafes and these new, you know, places coming in. So,
well, that social club, I think you need to do a Facebook Live out in front.
Right.
See how long you last.
Maybe you should do that at a social club in some other neighborhood.
Well, I wanted so bad to get a photo with. That guy from Grand Avenue, but I mean, I just met him today. I mean, because we have a mutual friend, so that's how I kind of talked to him. Like, oh, hey, do you know Dave? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, I just moved into Dave's building, so we started talking then. And then, you know, I was like, oh man, I'd love to get a photo of this guy, me and this guy together.
You'll see him around. Like, once you get into the neighborhood, you'll see him around.
Oh, exactly.
You know how it is. He's got to see you several times before he's going to do much more than exchange surface pleasantries.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he'll just do small talk to me probably until he sees me enough around the area. Yeah,
right. Be a little awkward.
Then, you know, because even just by knowing our mutual friend is not enough for that. I'm like, oh yeah, you know Dave from Coal Fire? He's like, oh yeah, I know Dave. I'm like, yeah. I grew up with him. Like we grew up together, like down the street from each other. I just moved into his building. He's like, oh wow, yeah. He's like, tell Dave I said hi. I'm like, oh yeah, I will. And then he's like, you know, I'll see you around. I'm like, oh, yeah, definitely.
You can say, Dave told me to get a selfie with you.
Well, you'll have some interesting experiences as you stay in that neighborhood for a while. I predict that you'll get started talking to these guys.
We definitely plan on staying for a long time here and stuff. So it's like, and luckily a lot of these guys aren't really computer savvy, so they don't know about, you know, my Facebook stuff I do.
Yeah.
So even when I run into these guys, most of these guys have no idea, you know.
Yeah.
The only time Red told me, though, about a year and a half ago, the mobster John Matassa, I guess Red's old FBI handler called Red one day and goes, hey, your name popped up on an FBI wiretap recently.
Oh, really?
And Red's like, oh, really? He's like, yeah. And he goes, yeah. He goes, it was John Matassa talking to one of his associates saying, hey, Red has resurfaced, and he's on this Facebook page with this idiot kid talking about the outfit. I'm like, I love that. I'm like, that's great, that the fact that he called me an idiot kid.
Really?
That's your new mob handle.
I know. So it's kind of funny, I guess. Like, so I guess someone must have... Well, I know there's a couple relatives who are in the group, the Facebook group, so I figured some of the younger guys probably know. And there's some guys, young guys who are associated with the outfit that talk to me, that they know I know who they are and stuff. I mean, they don't tell me anything that would get them in trouble.
Right.
But they're very supportive of it, though. They love the group, though. Because they're like, oh, man, I love seeing these old articles and stuff, you know? And they know I'm not trying to solve any, I'm not trying to solve any cases or trying to, like, hurt these people. I'm just putting old articles up there, you know?
Yeah. Now, and you're particularly a little bit safer because you don't like get, you know, write up what you see or hear. You just post newspaper articles. You may make a comment down deep in
it. Yeah, exactly.
But you just post a newspaper article that's, you know, old enough that, you know, it's all history. And they probably a lot more than you know. Creep your page and some of those the other pages up there just to see what people are talking about and what they're doing and kind of glory in.
I think a lot of these younger guys they want to see their name mentioned. You know, they get excited if they get mentioned in the group or something. You know, and stuff. But yeah, most of the people I talk about in the group are like most of them are dead pretty much. You know, so.
All right. Let's,
you want to get a liner from him here?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever got a liner from you. Oh, one other thing. I had the recorder running, but sometimes I'll play what we talk about before the show, but I don't know if I should on that. The FBI agent told Red that he heard his name mentioned on the wiretap. What do you think?
Oh, okay. I didn't know you were recording. Okay.
Yeah. I always turn it on as soon as I get started. I just won't play that. I'll cut that part out.
I don't think it's a big deal, but that's cool.
Sometimes he cuts the stuff that you write, like the stuff we're doing right now. I've been recording. He's got his recorder going and recording, and it'll end up at the end of the episode.
Yeah, where we're just bullshitting like this. People, you know, it's kind of like a little
second
show.
That should be the bonus material people have to pay for, though.
Okay, cool.
That whole separate category of everything we get outside of the bumper music.
Because I don't edit it or anything. I just plunk it down, and I don't even listen to it again. I sometimes think, oh, shit, what did we say? But it's usually not too bad. But this one in particular, I'm pretty aware of, you know, like we don't want some wiretap that's going on. Now, how long ago was that? Do you know?
November of 2017.
Okay. It was a year or so ago.
No, 2016.
That's long enough ago that it's not going to hurt anybody. And plus, you know, only the most diehard fan guy is going to listen all the way through into the closing music. And then listen to the other little show at the end that's just bullshit.
You got to wait and listen to this episode. He's talking to the guy from Chicago, and there he's
about on there. I mean, I don't think it would hurt the government's case, the stuff that we just talked about, you know? They were talking about Red, that's Red and me on a wiretap,
I was talking about Red a couple of years ago. Next thing you know, I didn't know they were going to know about it, and they did. They talk about it on this Gangland Wire Crime podcast. I go, that's me. I'm listening to the episode. They're talking with this guy from Chicago. I'm from Chicago. I know I talked about Red. Next thing you know, I got a wiretap. Sorry, I'm just going into character there.
He's going into character. We need to get him a job as a
radio personality.
Radio personality, yeah. All right.
It's not even a good Chicago accent.
It's kind of Italian, I guess. I don't know. Anyhow.
All right. So let's get that liner.
This is Mike Byrne. This is Mike Byrne, creator of the Chicago Outfit, old and current news articles, a Facebook group, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.